So welcome to episode 9 of Elmo's Corner of VentureCast. I'm Craig Severson of Grunt Media.
And I'm David Hornick from August Capital.
And we are back for another conversation, another round of hilarity, capital hilarity.
That's right. Nothing more exciting, nothing more hilarious than economics.
Yes, the economics of abundance and scarcity. First off, we wanted to thank Apple for putting us on iTunes front page. That was pretty cool.
That was great. You know, I was actually at the PopTech conference last week.
Uh-huh.
And one of the speakers was a guy who started Ask a Ninja.
Oh, yes. Kent.
Which is great. Just a hilarious video podcast. And so he was asked the question, well, how is it that you got all of your viewership? What was it that made you spread so quickly or whatever? And his answer was, well, we made this podcast. It was great. We liked it, and then the Apple folks saw it, and they put it on the front page of iTunes.
Yeah.
And then just went, and he said, we got 12,000 subscribers that week. Yeah. So, now I appreciate all of you who are listening. It turns out there aren't yet 12,000 of you subscribing, but, you know, each one of you could do your share.
We're really open to the format of this show, too, so it could be,
Ask a VC. Looking forward to funding you soon.
Podcasting. Right, that'd be good.
No, I absolutely love those guys, and I've had the pleasure of hanging out with them in the past, and it's such a delightful show, and to me, it's a great example of, you know, new media disruption and the fact that two guys with just really pure talent, a good knowledge of technology, can do this hilarious thing in their apartment room, and, you know, and it's totally catching, it's taking off, and they're finding revenue models. I just think it's great. I'm a huge fan, and it's just so encouraging of the stuff that's going on.
Absolutely. No, you look at something like that, or you look at the Mentos and Diet Coke video.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you've seen yet, but the guys who made that video are call themselves E.P. Bird. And
uh-huh.
E.P. Bird were these two out-of-work actors, I think. And they actually have a trailer for the new one that they're working on.
Right.
More involved, more incredible video. And obviously, they were encouraged. As I heard it, last time I heard it reported, they had made $40,000 from that first video.
Yeah.
So, you know, great. They've made $40,000. They're now encouraged to do something even more spectacular and see if that it can be paid for. And that's great.
Yeah, totally. And on this line, an interesting news thing that came up this week was United Talent Agency, UTA, opened up an online talent division looking for online media talent. So an actual Hollywood agency is now getting hip, getting cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of us, it's interesting, because I know a lot of LA podcasters like Ask a Ninja and Tim Street of French Maids and then up here as well. I'm up here. So it's kind of like I've always been joking with them. It's like, you know, you guys are looking for the agency, you know, and us guys, we're looking for like the VCs. You know, it's like the Silicon Valley LA thing. It's like we're all about business models up here and they're all about entertainment. And you know what? It's fine. I mean, and obviously that's a gross generalization. But if you do look at the type of programming, the type of programs that people are doing, it is that way. The LA people, I live there, I grew up there. That's the vibe. And it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, there's no question that how people approach these things is impacted by where they are and sort of the ecosystem of those places. So, but I think this idea of a talent, you know, online talent agent, if you look at Lonely Girl 15,
right.
this show that everybody, oh my goodness, is it or is it not this incredibly well done podcast of a group of teenagers? Well, no, it turns out it wasn't. It turns out that it was a production of a bunch of talented, but again, not famous, not yet necessarily represented people. And now you look at, I can assure you that that woman who plays, what's her name?
The Lonely Girl.
Yeah, right. Sad. That's just sad. Anyway, she'll be represented. There's just no question. And what's more, she's charming and great.
Yeah.
And so it'll be an interesting thing to watch as, again, new media drives old media in a way that hasn't historically been the case.
That's true, with the whole distribution thing being now the question, and that's the big infrastructure. It's kind of, you know, once infrastructures tend to crumble or have holes in them, just like the web was and when it first started, you know, the infrastructure of getting print or just basic data out the door suddenly went away one night. And you didn't need to print things. You didn't need a newspaper necessarily to tell your story. So it's so wonderfully, I don't know if wonderfully is the word, but it's so clearly capitalistic, this notion, because those of us who are doing content like me, we have to do quality work to make a living out of it. So it's not like it's just going to be a complete wasteland. you know, there's only so much attention people have. It's the attention economy, to use a buzzword. There's a buzzword. Right.
Buzzword alert.
But it's true. And I find it rather exciting to, I mean, in these early days, we are very, it's a very much a cooperative sort of things amongst us. People are in the podcasting world really into building up the notion of this type of media and, you know, working together. And I think that probably will stay as long as we all, if it stays within this smaller, private, individual creator thing, it'll be great. If we start building huge networks and just become the man again, then I don't think it's going to work out all that well. So
well, it's an interesting question with respect to things like Gawker Media, where you take, okay, here were bloggers who were getting attention, were getting big audiences, and mm-hmm. then someone like Nick Denton says, gee, if I aggregate a group of these people and hire people to create content, I can create essentially a media publishing business.
Yeah.
And so it became more like the sort of old classic Condé Nast than sort of the individual boing boings of this world.
Yeah.
And so it will be interesting to see whether those models continue, or whether the folks who prevail are the individuals who are inspired by whatever it is that they do.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are the gadget freaks become the leading gadget bloggers, not the, you know, Engadgets or Gizmodos that are created to fill a void.
Yeah. And I was just thinking while you were saying that blogs are interesting. Obviously, there's this close relationship between blogs and podcasts because it is basically the same mechanism of distribution. And still, we have a lot of great individual blogs out there. And I was reading a lot last night just in getting the news about what's happening in the venture world and in business. And it's really interesting that these individual people are doing this. They haven't all been bought out yet, and I don't think it's an inevitability. I think there's going to be plenty of room for talented individuals with good ideas and reasonable production skills.
If you look at the venture capital blogs, mm-hmm. there's no reason to be bought out, right? I mean, venture capitalists are blogging for reasons other than
sure.
making ad revenue on their blogs. So, in fact, you know, I know that a few of the venture capital bloggers are putting ads on their blogs, but then they're donating that money to charity. It's not.
Yeah.
It's just to understand the medium and understand and appreciate how these tools work. If you look at Fred Wilson's blog, he's mm-hmm. AVC. Fred,
time.
You know, says unabashedly, I am going to try everything. Because people, you know, recently someone complained about that Fred's blog was so cluttered, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
the MySpace of venture capital blogs. And, you know, he said, too bad. I'm
yeah.
not going to change that because I want to try these things. I want to see how they work. The whole point of it
right.
is to see how they work. Then, you know, the contrast is if you look at venture blog, I mean, it's the same boring tech. You know, my view of it has always been, I'm happy to comment on the venture capital business, but it's about the text. It's
yeah.
about the words and the thought. And you can. I'm just as happy to have you subscribe in RSS and read the whole post there as to come to VentureBlog. You don't
yeah.
get a whole lot more when you come to VentureBlog. But if you mm-hmm. go to Fred's blog, you get a way lot. You get a way lot.
A way lot, dude.
You get a way lot more. That's, you know, which is a huge amount, a way lot. That's a giant
can
amount.
Can you quantify that for us, Mr.
Yes,
Warren?
A metric way lot is actually yeah. even more.
How do you monetize the way lot?
Well, actually, it's much easier to... never mind.
So speaking of blogs, you're wearing a Vox shirt.
You
guys
I am.
Said your Six Apart had its launch party last night.
Yeah, I was over there. In fact, I got this T-shirt in the gift bag along with a little Vox bangle for my cell phone. So
excellent.
It was great. I mean, it's, you know, for those people who are listening and haven't heard of Vox, I mean, Vox is the next platform, the next blogging platform from Six Apart. Six Apart are the guys who originally wrote Movable Type, which mm-hmm. was one of the early platforms for bloggers that gave the flexibility to do, you know, all of the things you want in design and distribution, etc. And then that same team, Ben and Mina Trott, and then a growing organization built Typepad, which is the hosted blogging platform. And then I funded the company, and we bought a company called LiveJournal, which is really more social network than blogging platform. It's a combination and about journals and conversations. And so this fourth of the platforms from Six Apart is a combination of all of those things. It's really intended to be a very simple, straightforward way to talk about the things that you care about and mm-hmm. post pictures and post video. And then not only do that, but also control who reads it. So some things you can post and allow them to be read by the world, and other things you post and they're just viewable by family. And
I see. Groups you create custom with.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, you know, my you can go to Hornet, No, it's David Hornick. You go to davidhornick.vox.com. Too many blogs. Right, too many blogs. You go to davidhornick.vox.com, and you look at it, you'll see a commentary on random media things, truly random. But then if my mother goes to davidhornick.vox.com, she'll see lots of pictures of my kids and video
separate,
of
separate
my kids.
Entries then, whole entries that the general public doesn't see.
Absolutely. They won't, because as when you log in as my mother, then it recognizes you as someone who has access to this whole set of content that other people wouldn't necessarily see. And so now I have the capacity to put up videos of my kids where I wouldn't otherwise have. I mean, my wife is very conscious about the security of putting photos and video up. And now with Vox, she's more than happy to have us post like crazy. Right. So, in fact, the happiest person on the planet about Vox is my mother. My mother has sent me emails saying, "What does Mina Trott want for Christmas?" You know,
that's so sweet. Well, she also commented on our thing about names today, too, right?
She sent me an email
for the podcast.
Yes, she wants me to change it to Venturesome.
Venturesome, which I actually think is pretty clever. I like, I mean, you know.
All right. No, you know, look, Craig, it's all yours.
No,
defer to you completely.
I think
you and my mother.
Well, either that or we can do Venture Nation with a bow to the Dig Nation guys. We could have
Venture Nation, but
we'll have root beer, you know.
And do you think they own, have you guys trademarked Nation?
That's right.
Shoot me an email if you think that you own. Because, you know, look, it turns out Apple thinks they own Pod. Apple has sued around the word Pod.
They're sued around it because they're protecting iPod.
Yes, but they're suing, you know, people who make, I don't know, this pod and that pod.
Right.
So that's it's a tricky one, right?
A tricky one because you have to protect your trademark. So you are forced to, you know this probably better than I do, you're forced to protect a trademark, right? If it seems like it's intruding and you don't do anything about it, there's an implication there that you don't care or...
It can weaken the value of a trademark if you don't enforce it. So that's absolutely the case. But there are extremes, of course.
But for now, I mentioned Venture Nation and Dig Nation because I listen to those guys every week. And so it's an homage, but we're not going to call this Venture Nation.
Yeah, we promise.
But we could.
Venture Nation. What else? We talked about, I put in my Venture blog, VC Cast.
VC Cast
or...
And I had Venture Rant.
Venture Rant, you had Venture Blab.
Venture Blab.
what was that? I had some other one. Venture Blogcast. Oof. That's awfully long.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got to fit in that. You know, we got to keep the graphic.
Yeah,
think
you're
about
right.
The graphic.
You're right.
So Venture Some, yeah, that fits. Anyway, so I wanted to talk a little bit about the audio thing because I found that sort of interesting and I didn't quite understand it. So maybe you can give me your first impressions on it.
Sure. No, I think it is very interesting. I mean, the idea that... that entrepreneurs raise a big round of money and try a number of things, some of which work, some of which don't, and then decide that the best thing for the company is to buy back the company from the investors. And so apparently they're not talking about how much they paid, which is interesting. I mean, TechCrunch is speculating that they paid more than the $5 million that came in to buy back the assets, and I think that's probably highly unlikely. I think that they probably paid the $5 million or less for... Mm-hmm. The capacity to kind of move forward. So it doesn't. What's interesting is that venture capitalists are investing a lot earlier now than they were, and this is an indication of why that sometimes doesn't work. And this is a question: is this a bubble phenomena, or is this just that there are lots of activity that may prove interesting and may not? And so Odeo was a very early stage company when it went around raising money, and it ended up raising a lot of money, a surprising amount of money given the stage. They raised $5 million when Ev was thinking about some interesting ideas around podcasting. And
podcasting at that time hadn't really had any solid revenue modeling behind it, right? It was still pretty early.
Yeah, you know,
right?
quite early. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Odeo was thinking of doing two things. It was thinking of being a directory of podcasts, and it was also going to be a podcast creation engine, a way to make these podcasts. And then what happened was a number of major players emerged doing all of those things. You know, iTunes incorporating podcasts had a big impact because suddenly there is a directory of podcasts. Yahoo created a podcast directory, and there became a number of ways to create the podcasts themselves. So what happened, at best I can tell, and I'm not an investor. I'm friends with Ev. I think he's a smart guy. Mm-hmm. But I don't have any inside knowledge of what went on over there. But they had their audio business, and then they started working on this thing called Twitter, which had a big impact. People liked it. And this, you know, the idea of sort of mobile blogging and it started evolving in a more interesting way, I think, than what was happening at Odeo. And so I have to assume that there were disagreements about how the company might move forward with the investors who'd put money into podcasting. And
I see.
That perhaps there was an opportunity where the founders of the company, Ev and Biz and the other guys, were able to say, look, why don't we buy back the company and then we'll pursue the things that make sense to us. And mm-hmm. So, you know, if they had taken a small amount of money from angel investors, I think there would have been more flexibility to figure out what were the right models and then take a larger amount of money to sort of accelerate the business. So, but again, I'm just speculating, but I think congratulations to the guys for being able to continue to move forward in a direction that makes sense. And I hope that it worked out well with the investors and that everybody is leaving the table happy.
I mean, my first take, it seemed like it had a lot of integrity. You know, they were seeing that they could run their funding down, but he just decided no. You know, that he could see that it might not be worth spinning the wheels for the next couple of years to do that. So anyway, we'll probably learn more about it as the week goes by, but very interesting. It does raise this question about the involvement of, you know, venture capital. We touched on this last week, where companies don't need as much money to get going. There's less nuts and bolts kind of companies out there. So give me the basic rundown or the basic definition and differences between an angel investor and a VC, if you don't mind such a basic question.
No, sure. I mean, you know, so to go to the pure, to the very beginning, an angel investor is characterized by typically being an individual who is investing money at the earliest stage. This is there is an individual or group of individuals, they're ready to create a business and they don't want to fund it themselves. So the earliest form is I fund it myself. Maybe you're Joshua Schachter and you late nights and weekends create something while you have a day job. Then eventually you say, "Gee, I want to focus on this thing." You leave the business you had, and you have to invest your time and ultimately your own money to develop that company. And then the next phase, when you've gotten to the point where you can no longer fund it or it no longer makes sense to you to fund it, typically you'll then go to an angel investor. And these angels tend to be individuals. Classically, they were viewed as doctors and dentists, right?
Oh.
For a long time, it was go to this group of doctors and dentists and they'll fund you with the money because they were the high net worth individuals of their various communities. And in fact, you know, Subway Corporation has I forget what the name of it is. It's actually a doctors collective. And so its historical name is something to do with that history.
Subway the sandwich shop?
Subway the franchise sandwich shop. We should check that out.
Okay.
If we don't talk about it this week, we should look it up because it's funny. I mean, that was the history of it.
Wow.
So angels are, maybe it's dentists and doctors. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's the individuals in your family who have the most money that they're willing to put at risk.
Retired venture capitalists.
Right, exactly. Then there's maybe retired venture capitalists. And in Silicon Valley, it tends to be individuals who've made a lot of money by pursuing their own business that then can invest in future businesses. So folks like Josh Koppelman, who started Half.com and created a group that's actually a very organized angel group. It's called First Round Capital, and is in fact a fund. So it's not your classic angel investor, but early stage investor. And it came out of the fact that Josh, you know, wanted to invest in future entrepreneurs and continue to build companies. Reid Hoffman, who was one of the senior execs at PayPal, has invested in a number of companies, and as has Peter Thiel, the former CEO of PayPal. So you find these sets of individuals. Ram Shriram is angel invested in a number of incredibly successful companies. The biggest, of course, is Google. And he had made a bunch of money by selling his company to Amazon. So that's the traditional angel as an individual with enough money that they can afford to invest a couple of $100,000, $500,000.
And how does the deal work? Is it a It's not a loan. It's they're buying equity in the company then?
It depends, actually. Historically, mm-hmm. it was a loan. Historically, I'm speaking mainly for Silicon Valley, but the mode in Silicon Valley would be you go to a group of angels and you'd create this thing called a bridge loan. And a bridge loan meant that these set of angels would give you money as a loan, mm-hmm. but that it would become equity when you raised money from the professional investors, right?
From the round A?
So the Series A Series investor, A. which would typically be a venture capitalist, okay. would say, okay, I'm going to invest $5 million at a $10 million valuation and buy a third of the company. And by the way, all of your angel investors, the $1 million you raised in the first instance, will also convert in this round at the same valuation. And so we actually, it would be like raising $6 million, only you spent $1 million of it. And what the angel investors get out of that is they get a discount of some sort in this loan to the company mm-hmm. that says, I'm going to get 130% of the value of the shares. So I'm going to risk something coming early.
Yeah.
And so I'll get an extra amount of equity on top of what I would have bought with my dollar.
Got it.
So that's a typical angel investment. And then after angel money has been put to use and the company progresses, then they go out to venture capitalists. They come up and down Sand Hill Road mm-hmm. or wherever, nowadays downtown Palo Alto, and try to raise a more significant amount of money. So I'd say a typical angel round is $1 million or, you know, $1.5 million, maybe $500,000. Typically, when you get to venture capitalists, you're raising $4 million or $6 million or, you know, maybe even more. And so then you tend to go to the professional investors, and those are the venture capitalists who have funds. We raise our funds from foundations and universities. And so, for example, August Capital has a $500 million fund. So lots mm-hmm. of money mm-hmm. that's been aggregated from foundations and universities and potentially wealthy individuals. And we invest that money on their behalf. And so someone will come to me and have an interesting idea, and I will propose buying, you know, a quarter of the company for some number of millions of dollars, and it's an equity transaction, and mm-hmm. then I go on the board and try and help the company be successful.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So how does it work then with Odeo buying out? Now, I see this was Charles River was the venture firm, and then it says a bevy of angel investors. So the angel investors apparently still had skin in the game, even though Charles River, in this particular instance, had come on board?
Right. In my understanding was that Odeo simultaneously raised money from Charles River and also from a group of angels to get them involved all in the exact same round.
Oh, at the same time.
I believe at the same time
in
that instance.
And so then when Odeo decides to do what they did, they can just do that? Is there a deal with your venture people that you... Again, this comes back to my question last week. You know, can the venture people say no? You can't buy us back?
Sure, absolutely.
I mean,
as it's described on TechCrunch, mm-hmm. Odeo bought the assets. So essentially what they did was the founders created a new corporation.
Mm-hmm. Obvious
and
Corp.
put mm-hmm. money into, what did they call it? They
Obvious Corp.
The Obvious Corp. So
yes.
I guess, which is hilarious. So That's they great. Create Obvious Corp. Mm-hmm. And then Obvious Corp says, I'm going to buy the assets of the company.
Okay.
And now that is a board level decision. The board of the company gets to decide whether or not to sell the assets. And in fact, in most venture investments, the venture capitalist or the majority of the venture capitalists investing have a right to say yes or no to any acquisition. So okay. that one in particular, I'd be stunned if the venture investors didn't have to approve the deal.
Okay.
And so they must have determined that this was a good thing for the company, the right thing to do with their money, right thing for everyone involved. And so as a board, they all collectively vote to sell the assets to Obvious Corp. Obvious Corp pays some amount of money. And then I assume what will happen is that Odeo Corp will liquidate
mm-hmm.
and distribute the money to the investors on a pro rata basis. So
okay. And then like we talked about last week, now you're in the venture phase, you have venture funding, then sort of the next phase for a company is either the IPO or the acquisition. Then this is sort of another big thing that's happening now is where are all the IPOs? Where have they gone? Is it? I can't imagine the joy of creating a public company anymore. I mean, Sarbanes-Oxley probably is a big part of that, but is the business environment changing so much that we really are creating less companies these days? Less public companies, I mean?
Yeah, I think that the fact that there aren't as many public companies is more a condition of the market, right? Mm. The market is inherently skeptical these days about technology companies. I think, frankly, they're inherently skeptical about all companies. And so for new companies to get public, they have to have a real track record of success. And so that takes a while. So I think that we're starting to see more and more technology companies that have spent the time to create a real business, a big business that has a lot of revenue, is cash flow positive, has an interesting growth rate. And those businesses will continue to get public. And so the question then is it in the entrepreneur's interest to be a public company versus being a private company versus being acquired by a public company and not having to go through that process?
Right.
So, which is absolutely a fair question. I think that for sure there are a lot more burdens these days on companies when they are public companies.
Right.
And it's been described in lots of ways. It's described as a multi-million dollar tax on the company. Compliance with Sarbanes-Oxley costs a lot of money. It also requires individuals to assure finances in a way that they hadn't had to do in the past. Now, you know, from my perspective, I don't think that it should be a large burden. I think you should feel perfectly comfortable in guaranteeing that the finances that you're signing off on are, in fact, the finances of the company. On the other hand, the sets of rules around regulating the control of those corporations and who can invest in what and who can sit on boards and all of those things haven't, in my mind, seemed to add a whole lot of protection to the public. But they have created a whole lot of cost and a lot more bureaucracy, and it does make it a lot less pleasant to be a public company.
Right. And then there's this whole thing of, what's your motive? Is it satisfying the shareholders or your customers if you're making products? And of course, that's a classic thing that's been going on forever.
And that's a timing question in a lot of ways, right? Because of course you want to satisfy your customers. You need to sell more of whatever it is you have. On the other hand, it will take a long time and cost a lot of money to get to the right answer. You may be punished in a short term by the market if you're a public company. Whereas if you're a private company, you may have more capacity to lose money for a period of time or make less money for a period of time while you're morphing your business into the thing that makes the most sense. So in fact, there's lots of activity now in the private equity world where there are big funds taking public companies private. And the, it's an amazing market. Companies where you didn't think it was possible to take them private are now being bought out by these private equity investors to the tune of multi-billion dollar deals.
Right.
And, you know, we were involved in one of those, in fact, one of the very, very early ones in this phase of takeovers, and that was the Seagate deal. And it was a big amount of money, $1 billion in cash, $1 billion in debt, plus a whole lot of equity that had that the company owned in a company called Veritas. Seemed like a monstrously large deal, and yet now it's paling in comparison to some of these other deals that are getting done. So That stuff is interesting because it's being fueled by an interest in getting out of that public reporting world that, that does seem pretty onerous these days.
And then super obvious question of the day, what are the benefits of going public? So it's a fast way to raise money, right? Is that basically you can just get a truckload of capital quickly? Is that?
You know what? I think that the reason companies go public are, there are a multitude of reasons. Amongst our reasons, like Monty Python, fear, surprise, a ruthless efficiency. Those are all good ones. the reason that companies go public, for one, they raise a bunch of money. I think that's right. You can raise hundreds of millions of dollars in a large IPO in a way where it would be a challenge to do that from individual investors or funds.
That's basically cash. Is that right?
Cash, cold hard cash. Yeah. You have your public offering and you sell some portion of your company at a particular valuation and the market then sells it to funds and individuals and allows you to efficiently sell $200 million worth of shares as opposed to $20 million, which you do. So that's helpful. Obviously, it gives you a bunch of money to help fund the growth of the company. The second thing is it creates this idea of liquidity. Liquidity is, how can I take stock, which otherwise, which it only has value if I can sell it to someone, and create a market that allows you to sell it to someone. Now, there are lots of rules once you're a public company about how you can and can't sell a share of stock. But once you're on a public market, then there is a market for it, right? There are people who look at the value of the company and say, I'll give you $20 for that share of stock. When it's a private company, it is extraordinarily difficult to take a share of private company stock and sell it. So this idea of liquidity is important because if you have investors who've invested a long time ago and would like to realize their gains, put $10 million in the company is now worth 10 times that. The only way that they can realize those gains is to find some liquidity. And the only forms of liquidity are you sell the company to someone and you get the returns from that, mm-hmm. or you take the company public and you have a market on which you can sell your shares. So people do that. They take companies public to get liquid. And then the other thing that is a huge advantage of a public company is that you now have stock, which is much more valuable in terms of acquisition. You look at Google. Yes. When Google bought YouTube, they bought it with $1.65 million of Google stock.
Billion, right?
Right. Excuse me, did I say million?
I'll take it.
$1.565 billion of Google stock, right?
So when you say that, that's $1.65 billion is the valuation of Google stock on that day based on the number of shares they...
So here's how you calculate it. When a public company acquires a company for a certain amount of money as opposed to a certain number of shares,
okay.
then in the M&A documents, in a past life I did a bunch of these M&A deals, and mm-hmm. the document itself has to calculate the value of the share price.
Yes.
Because then the way they get to the total number of shares they grant is they take the total price they're paying and they divide it by the share price. So usually the share price is determined by taking the trailing 5-day average. What was the average price over the previous 5 days to the day you signed the deal? So you determine the share price by taking this 5-day average, you divide it up, find the average price, and then you divide that $1.65 billion by the share price of however many hundreds of dollars it was in Google stock, mm-hmm. and that's the number of shares that they issue to the company to acquire it. And so the good news when you're a public company is those shares are not the same as cash. As long as you can get the authorization to create more shares, mm-hmm. then you can use those shares to acquire companies. Now, obviously, every time you create a bunch of shares, it dilutes everybody else's shares. Suddenly, you used to own 1% of the company, and now you own 0.75% of the company. Once you're a public company, that unless you are overly acquisitive with stock, rarely does the market look at it that way. They say, oh, you've acquired something interesting or not, and how valuable is it to the company? And so, as you saw with the YouTube deal, the value of Google stock went up. In fact, it went up more on a percentage basis than they paid for YouTube. So in theory, the market thought it was a smart move, and they actually rewarded them. They made more money than it cost them to acquire the company.
So on the first second of the acquisition, Google shareholders had a dilution of value. And then what you're saying is the market eventually recouped that dilution because they thought it was a good acquisition.
Absolutely. Okay. It cost about 1% of the company to buy YouTube, mm-hmm. and then the value of the company went up more than 1%
right.
in reaction to the deal. Okay. That's evidence of a great deal, that the market thinks that this is an accretive deal, that it's going to add more value than it costs.
Right.
Right. I mean, it has an impact, but the overall impact isn't treated the same way as if you took $100 million of your cash or, you know, $1 billion of cash and spent it, and suddenly you went from having $1 billion in cash to having no cash. Mm-hmm. That would be treated as a major problem in a corporation. Whereas if you spend $1 billion worth of stock, even though it's dilutive, mm-hmm. in fact, spending $1 billion in cash doesn't dilute the shareholder value, whereas spending $1 billion in equity does. And yet they're treated very differently by the investors and the investment community.
Right. Do we have time to talk about Chris Anderson's thing
that was sure.
on the blog?
You bet.
Because I found that really interesting. So you met with him at PopTech.
Right. So I was at this PopTech conference, which is a really fun, interesting conference that takes place up in Camden, Maine. It has the disadvantage of being way up in Camden, Maine, which is this 4-hour drive out of Boston. I guess you can fly into Portland and it would be a mere hour and a half drive.
Right.
Beautiful town right on the ocean. And they have this little theater that the conference is held in. And lots of interesting thinkers around technology and economy and the world come together and for a few days talk about interesting things like Chris Anderson's talk, which was about his idea of the economy of abundance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read your blog a bit and it struck my attention because my previous experience with Buckminster Fuller always talked about the notion of the economics of scarcity is irrelevant. You know, Malthus, when he created that theory back in 1810, it was based on a closed spherical system of England. you know, there were so many resources that were growing, and then population was growing greater, and so there had to be a crash at some point. And, you know, Fuller argued against that, that technology and better materials and refrigeration really is changing that equation. Is Chris talking about something similar to that, or is it in the same theme? Is he carrying the ball forward?
Well, I think that historically, the way technology has been thought about in terms of scarcity and abundance is that even with scarcity, technology makes it possible to create more from a scarce resource. So, for example, with spectrum, technology said that you could move a certain number of bits across a certain amount of spectrum, and so cell phone carriers were buying up spectrum, and they were hamstrung by the amount of information that they could transmit over that particular spectrum. But technology over time made it possible to move a whole lot more information over the same amount of spectrum. And so even though it was a scarce resource, by using technology, you could increase the value of that scarce resource to be more abundant. But the point of that was to create abundance, which you then would sell. And what Chris is saying in this sort of corollary to Long Tail is that technology has so overpowered that question, has so moved beyond the idea of creating greater capacity within a scarce resource to creating abundance. This idea that there is no scarcity, that storage is so cheap now that Google can say, we're going to launch an email service that has no, for all practical purposes, no storage requirements. Mm-hmm. So if you were using Yahoo Mail or you were using Hotmail and had 100 megabytes of storage, suddenly Gmail comes in and says you have a gigabyte of storage. It essentially blew the doors open and said, you need not worry about erasing things. Mm-hmm. Right? Whereas if you were a Hotmail or a Yahoo user, you could easily have gotten to log in at one point and it says to you, you're out of space. Erase mm-hmm. some stuff if you want to save anything more. Right? Google said, no, you know what? The cost of us just giving you more storage is so small that we're just going to do that. And it changed the nature of how people then used their email client. It changed the nature of the competition. It forced Yahoo and Hotmail to then remove barriers or to change the nature of the barriers to storage. So as you look at how storage gets incredibly cheap and therefore borders on free, or microprocessors. Now microprocessors, the number of transactions that you can do per square inch of a microprocessor is so much larger, courtesy of Moore's Law, this idea that the processing power is doubling and doubling and doubling again, that you can do all sorts of things that you wouldn't think of before. And in fact, as Chris pointed out in his talk, this idea that you can throw away transistors. In the early days of microprocessors, you had to be so efficient with every single transistor, and it had to be the most efficient path and the most, so that you could get the most out of a very expensive commodity. Now, you can really do a lot more and in some ways be inefficient, and yet that's the efficient thing to do. And, maybe again, we reach a point where we're using all of the processing power, and so we need mm-hmm. to be more efficient. But that is not the controlling factor now, right? Storage is no longer the controlling factor, and microprocessors are no longer the controlling factor, and bandwidth is increasingly not the controlling factor. And so as these things go from scarcity to abundance, then it changes the nature of how you should think about the software and services and hardware that you're building. And that was sort of Chris's point. And that it was time to start thinking about the economy of abundance, not the economy of scarcity.
Mm-hmm. But what makes me think then there is an abundance, I see that. I see the trend of abundance with these increasing technologies. But isn't there a commodification of the markets that are providing storage and providing bandwidth? I mean, isn't there a shrinkage in their world? Because it's so abundant, don't they start to lose a viability as a very profitable company? Or do they make it up in volume?
Right. If you are producing something that is purely commoditized, then the capacity to compete is always challenging.
Mm-hmm.
This is really about saying there are sets of commodities now that are approaching zero, that the way you approach the services you build on top of them mm-hmm. is different.
Right.
You still have to build differentiated services, but they can no longer be differentiated by these sets of commodities that you control. They have to be differentiated by the experiences that are built on top of them. So if you are xDrive versus iDrive, and before the way you competed for business was to say, we'll give you 100 megabytes of storage, And the only reason you could do that is you were incredibly efficient about how you use that storage, even mm-hmm. though it was expensive. then now you have a competitive advantage around the technology of making a scarce commodity less expensive. But if you're now one of these storage companies, the cost of 100 megabytes of storage is so small for both of them that you need to create value-added services on top of it that are not based on the efficiency of the storage itself, but are around how do you use that storage.
Right.
And so these new, in fact, these new next-generation storage companies that are out there are really thinking about that, thinking about the experience and how storage can now be used more interestingly in other things, and that's what they're enabling.
More and more, it seems, it comes down to the user experience, the services that you're offering, the design. Maybe I'm biased, but that does make me, you know, it makes me think that if the infrastructure is there, if the materials are there, if the technology is there, then people just have to be smarter about how it's used and how elegant it can be.
Well, so the flip side of what Chris was saying about this economy of abundance mm-hmm. is that if you have abundant capacity to do something, then you shouldn't try to figure out what the answer is. You should try and do it all. Do everything and allow your end users to determine which are the right ways to do things, right? Find out what are the, if you want to know what particular piece of content is compelling, create a whole bunch of it and see what people use. If you want to create a service that otherwise you might have been constrained by, you know, storage or bandwidth or whatever, now you have the capacity to make a service that does a whole bunch of things that may make sense and allow your end users to determine what is the compelling thing. So you look at interesting example that Chris gave was Wired Magazine. Wired just bought back the website wired.com and now it's reunited mm-hmm. and it feels so good.
We weren't going to sing.
Right. I'm sorry. I can't help myself. So now Wired and wired.com are now under the same roof mm-hmm. and Chris was saying as the editor-in-chief of Wired, the magazine, he has a certain number of pages. He has a scarce resource, which is the pages, and he has to make a decision which are the stories that he'll run and try and determine in his own mind what are the things that are compelling and put those in his magazine, despite the fact that he has more information that he could put in, but he has to make choices.
Right.
Whereas in Wired.com, he said, now I have the capacity to run everything and perhaps use something like a Dig-like experience or, you know, a Reddit experience mm-hmm. that will allow all of these potential pieces of content to rise to the top based on their popularity and interest. And so as an editor of .com, he doesn't have to make the choices about which of the things are compelling. He just has to make the choice of what things, you know, go do stories on a bunch of things and let the community determine which are the interesting things.
Right.
And so it's an interesting paradigm.
Right. Well, the community and or the search engine for an individual who maybe doesn't really care about what the larger community thinks. They can, you know, so we have that combination now with social networking and dig models. With those, with the combination of those two things, we have the best of both worlds. We have a somewhat of an editorialized process with the social group thinking what a good story is. And you have that, you know, nano level specificity of the search that is actually starting to work.
Absolutely.
Better.
I mean, this is why I say this is the flip side to the long tail, because what it enables is the long tail. It enables incredibly niche content to find an audience and to be created. If you didn't have the capacity, if you had to make choices about which stories to save, you wouldn't save the story that appealed to 17 people. Mm-hmm. You'd save the story that appealed to 17 million people. Mm-hmm. But now with this economy of abundance, you can save it all and using search engines, find things that otherwise would have been very difficult to match a market and the content because the mm-hmm. the combination right. was so small. And that's
right.
exciting. I mean,
it
that's
is, yeah.
that's what's powering the new economy as far as I'm concerned. That's what's powering new media and how music
exactly.
is being created and consumed and video and podcasts and all of that.
Well, you said it's the opposite of the long tail, and it made me think of a comment I got from Rajat Baharia, a friend of mine from formerly of IDEOS, now with Bunchball, and we were talking this week over email, and you know, he sort of threw out this idea, like, it seems like YouTube and Dig got really popular because of hits. Like, YouTube got popular from Lazy Sunday, Saturday Night Live. It sort of got that ball rolling. And Dig got notoriety through this thing with, I think it was Paris Hilton or something. And it was an interesting point, is that, you know, they kind of rose to the top. And did they rise to the top because there was a hit? Or, you know, did they rise to the top because they had the structure in place to make that hit happen? Just a sort of, I thought it was a really interesting thought. Like, you know, what about the other people who didn't get the hit? Is it luck? Is it the roll of the dice?
Well, it is an interesting question. To what extent does the head content, the stuff that appeals to big groups of people, mm-hmm. then drive the capacity to serve the tail.
Oh, okay, right.
Right. And mm-hmm. so it's absolutely the case that if you look at a YouTube, there are pieces of content that resulted, that were spread wildly and resulted in lots and lots of people coming to the site who hadn't been there before. And then they found a whole bunch more that they found appealing. And so, and the same with Dig or with any of these phenomena where they get very interesting by virtue of something that's really compelling, right? Look at Jib Jab's a great example. The "This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land" piece of animation that they created mm-hmm. around the election was unbelievably compelling. People shared it like crazy, and then people found Jib Jab, and Jib Jab was able to create a larger community and a larger business and is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting question, because if we think that this is an economy about the little guys mm-hmm. finding audiences, it is to a certain extent, but it is still about the hit.
Yeah.
The hit will, but what's changed is that the hit is not driven by the record industry or the movie makers
right.
or necessarily. Maybe it is, but you don't any longer need to have millions of dollars in marketing budget to find an audience. And
true.
So you can be the Eepy Bird guys with their, you know, Mentos and Coke video mm-hmm. and find an audience that they were having trouble finding as actors in New Hampshire or Vermont, wherever they were. So that's that's what's changed. But there's still always going to be these hits that create attention, and this is a big attention economy, and people tell their friends about it, and suddenly yeah. you have these communities that grow, but they have to have something compelling so that when you find your way there, you stick around.
Right. That is an interesting differentiation, because you do have the hit, but in the old days, in the old media model, the hit was isolated. It was a isolated phenomenon. If there was a hit song, you maybe went to the album as a consumer, but that's kind of as far as you got, you know, just in the record store. Maybe you went to the record store. Yeah, maybe you saw the things at the record store, but you didn't really have this capacity to get immersed. But now if there's a hit, it's no longer an island. Usually it's in this, like we're saying, in this sea of this other material. So I think that is actually a very significant difference. And that's probably what's the most interesting thing part about that question.
And what's happening is that the design of these services is not just about serving that content so that people come and find it compelling, but then also creating an experience that makes it easy to go mm-hmm. look at other things.
Right. And
so
right.
if you're a blogger, if it just showed you a blog post, someone pointed you to a particular blog post and all you found was a blog post, you'd be done.
Yes.
But blogs have this incredibly interesting structure now where you can read the past blog posts, you can click through to links of things that they're talking about, which then link to other things mm-hmm. and find your way around. And so this referential and self-referential system allows you to spend a whole lot of your time consuming a host of new media that you wouldn't have otherwise. And that's mm-hmm. and so it's product design. It's that YouTube is designed in a way to make you watch the next video.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Six Apart is thinking about how to build blogging software that allows you to bring in an audience and keep them.
Right. Excellent. Well, speaking of Web 2.0 things, we're going to be at the conference next week.
Absolutely.
Right?
Be great.
So warning everyone that we'll invade with microphones, possibly.
we will track you down and ask you questions.
And I want to thank again CacheFly for providing bandwidth for this show. And do we have any closing thoughts, prayers, incantations?
Let us know. We need to know what you think you should
right.
be calling. If we should change it from VentureCast to something else, we'd love to know. And more importantly, we want to know what you are interested in hearing about.
Yeah, so. Because thank you for the emails and the comments we've gotten so far. And it's great just to open the dialogue up a little bit more, because you know, we're both geeks in our own kind of way, and we love talking about stuff. So send us your ideas, story ideas, and we'll go from there. Thank you very much.
All righty.
Those who have savings often invest or lend them, hoping for a share of profit, and in so doing, help to build the industrial might of the nation.
It seems that capitalism means different things to different people.